name is Muhammad Ali, and you will announce it right.
Oh, my goodness.
Lionel Messi does it again. He's superhuman.
Welcome, everybody, to the first edition of what we hope will be a regular podcast. This is Bittersweet Symphony. Joining me, as always, is my partner in crime, the great Roger Mitchell. Roger, come in.
Hi, Grant. How are you?
Mate, I'm very, very well indeed. Very, very well indeed.
Good.
Really, really looking forward to this conversation, I have to say.
Yeah. As you say, this is a pilot. Over this year, you and I have reflected, and maybe it's a question of the kind of thing that happens when you get to our age, but I don't think it's an age thing. It's not
your age, Roger, your age.
Yeah. the fact that, you know, I think it's relatively well established that people talk about the soundtrack to their lives and various songs and artists that they can pinpoint to a part of their lives. And you and I believe that that's very much the same for sport. And we believe that there is a strong linkage there. There's a lot of sports people who are deeply connected to music. And what we want to explore here is that there's a lot of music people deeply, deeply connected to sport. And the idea with this pilot, Grant, is that we would like to explore that with somebody that we've got in mind that I think can be a great kind of like companion to this bittersweet symphony, as you say, and tell us some stories and introduce new people to the podcast that can share with us how these two great elements in life are important.
Yeah, beautifully put. I mean, for me, obviously, again, I play the role of the fan here. You know, I've been a sports fan all my life. I've been a music fan all my life. And there is so much in this, Roger. You know, I will hear a song come on the radio and I've heard one bar of it and I'm back in a specific place at a specific time,
exactly,
doing a specific thing. And sport is the same. You know, with the passing of Diego Maradona recently, I remembered where I was. I remember sitting watching that quarterfinal in Mexico City. I was back in that room with my mates.
Yes, you were, yeah.
And that commonality between the two makes them such great bedfellows, but obviously the memories, they are bittersweet. And so I'm so thrilled that we've got our guest to agree to come on and do this with us. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about who our guest is and fill in some of the background, because some people will know him, many people won't, but everyone's going to love him, I'm sure.
Yes, Billy Sloan, for the best part of 30 or 40 years, has been a bit of a doyen of music journalism in the UK and certainly in Scotland, where he's been undoubtedly number one. But he's been the kind of music critic that has lived the journey with the artist rather than report on them from afar. I think Billy's uniqueness is that he's been in the dressing rooms of both the artists and many, many sports stars as he has sought his own journey of following what he readily admits are his heroes. He doesn't like the phrase, don't get too close to your heroes. You'll hear on this pilot episode him talk about anecdotes with Bruce Springsteen, Grace Jones, Paul McCartney, Keith Richards, Mike Tyson, Pele, Ali McCoist, and...
don't forget Cassius Clay.
Cassius Clay, yes. And I think this will give you a flavour for what we're trying to achieve here. It's a long podcast, but we didn't feel that any of the things we heard we wanted to cut out. So interesting were they. And, you know, if we find that this resonates, I think we'll attempt with Billy to get some of these people onto the show in the first person and tell us more of their relationship between music, their first love and their profession, and their sporting interests.
Yeah, again, nicely put, Roger. I mean, this is, as Roger said, this is a long podcast, so we're going to split this into two parts. The stories you're going to hear are are not only wonderful, evocative stories, but beautifully told by a master storyteller. And, you know, Billy Sloan is someone who has spent his life on the other side of the microphone, and he's interviewed all the greats, and he spent time asking questions. And this is really one of the first times, I think, that Billy's had the chance to sit and tell the stories rather than just kind of coax them out of other people. And boy, did he do a good job, Rog.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yes, very nicely put. So I would say, no further ado, let's just get Billy Sloan on to Bittersweet Symphony.
Well, Billy, welcome to the pilot episode of Bittersweet Symphony. I'm so, so glad you could join us today.
I'm glad to be aboard.
And joining me, as always, is my foil. It's the man himself, Roger Mitchell.
Hello, Grant. Good to hear from you, and great to hear from you, Billy. You've been a hero of mine for a long, long time.
Now, this is you gentlemen, don't forget, I'm a poor Englishman stuck between two Glaswegians. So you two need to remember that I don't want to have to use subtitles to understand this conversation. Once you get back into
fine.
The Gorbals or wherever it is you go,
fine.
Just spare a thought for the poor Englishman hanging on for dear life. So, Billy, the topics at hand are two topics that I know have played significant roles in your life, and that's music and sport. And Roger and I... Roger having been in both industries as an executive, and me having lived an entire life through, it seems, a musical soundtrack and sporting events throughout the whole of my adult life. It's just something that we've always wanted to put together, and to get the chance to talk to you, someone who has lived a life in music, and I'm fascinated to see how sport has intersected with you along the way. So if we can... we'd love to go right back and find out how you got into music journalism, and perhaps if you can weave in your first connections with sport as a wee boy, that would be the perfect way to start.
Well, the journalism thing was an ambition. You know, I remember going to the careers master when I was about 14 or 15 at school, and you know, he was basically asking you the big $64,000 question, which was, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? Now, yeah. you didn't really know at that time. But I did have aspirations to be a journalist, but I did not know how to go about it. And in those days, it was pretty much of a closed shop. It was almost catch 22, because to get into a reasonable newspaper, you had to be in the union. But to get into the union, you had to be working for a newspaper. So it was a kind of tricky situation. But what really kind of spurred me on was this careers master, who should have been doing everything to encourage me, because I was on the cusp of leaving school, basically said, in 10 years' time, there won't be any such things as newspapers. So forget it, you know, get another career. Now, even if that had been true, which it isn't, and it wasn't, he should have been doing everything to encourage me rather than discourage me. And I remember vividly walking out the classroom after the meeting with him, thinking, you know, I'll show you. But I really wanted to show myself, because, you know, I wanted to get into journalism, but I did not have a clue how you went about it. So... you know, the first jobs I got when I left school, you know, I worked in an office just sort of doing, you know, bookwork and paperwork. And then I got a job in a building site, which was arguably the best job I ever had in my life. I was labouring in a building site with joiners and plumbers and labourers and bricklayers. And I was making quite a bit of money. You know, my mates were all earning, you know, 50, 60 quid a week. I was earning 80, 90 quid a week with all the overtime and weekend work and stuff. And I was as fit as a fiddle. I know you'll find this hard to believe, but I was eating like a horse, and I had a 28-inch waist. But I was keen to get into journalism. So lo and behold, I lived in a place in Springburn in Glasgow, in the north of Glasgow, quite a kind of tough working class area. It was a great place. I loved living there. And they had a local paper called the Springburn Times. And just on spec one day, I wrote a letter saying, I noticed that you don't have a music column. I'll write one for you for free on the understanding that you put my name on it, thinking that, you know, if they put stories by Billy Sloan, I'd be able to, you know, compile some kind of cuttings file. And, you know, if I ever was lucky enough to get an interview for a proper job in journalism, I could take a portfolio and say, well, you know, here's some of the articles I've had published. And then when I went for the interview, you know, to do this music column, the woman who was the editor was a great lady who still a dear friend called Nina Young. And her and I just kind of really hit it off. You know, she liked me and I liked her right from the start. And it turned out that just by sheer coincidence, they were looking for a reporter to cover the Springburn area. And she asked me if I was interested in the job. And of course, I was. The only problem was that the wages were £19 a week.
Oh.
So I was earning, you know, 80, 90 quid a week in the building sites. And I thought, how do I go from 80, 90 quid a week in the building sites to 19 quid a week? And at that time, I was married and I had a child. And I thought, you know, how am I going to do this? But I had a bit of savings and I was able to bite the bullet. And I took the job. And what was great was that, you know, it was two newspapers. It was Springburn, the Springburn Times and the Bishop Briggs Times. And, you know, Bishop Briggs is very kind of middle class and, you know, back in front door and a car in the driveway. And you went to, you know, Mallorca twice a year. Whereas, you know, Springburn was the total opposite. You know, they were pretty working class, pretty rough and ready. And it was great. It was fantastic training. You know, I was a bit too late to go to journalistic college. So, you know, I was... I'd missed the boat for that one. So I literally arrived in the ramshackle office on the very first day, and the guy, Andy Patterson, who worked in the office, said, right, Joe Bloggs and Novar Drive or whatever has just won £1,000 on the spot the ball contest. Get the photographer and go up and find out what he's going to spend the money on. And literally 15 minutes later, I was knocking this guy's door and saying, can I come in and speak to you, Mr. Bloggs? You know, here you've just won the spot the ball competition in some evening newspaper. And, you know, 10 minutes later, we were getting his story and getting him to post for a picture with a cheque. So it was great training because, you know, one minute you were covering a council meeting, the next week you were covering a BB football match, the next time it was a garden fete. So it was really in at the deep end. And I absolutely loved it because, you know, the people in Springburn used the local paper as a kind of sword of authority with which to, you know, fight the council and to put right any injustice that they seem to be, you know, fearing that, you know, was coming their way. So they would phone up the local paper and say, you know, they're getting rid of the lollipop man at Ellenvale School. This is a scandal. What are you going to do about it? You know, you should take up the fight. And we did, and it was great. So that's basically how I got into newspapers. It was a great training ground. I was really happy doing that job, and it was they were great years and great times, even though it was, you know, very much flying by the seat of your pants.
You know, it's fascinating. What a really interesting object lesson for anybody. That, I mean, the entrepreneurial spirit you showed there in terms of saying, look, you haven't got a journalist, I'll do it for nothing, but I want my byline. That shows a clarity of thought about the industry and perhaps an understanding of that industry and how it would work to your advantage in the future that not so many people probably have.
But there was method to my madness because, yeah. You know, and a quiet week, you know, when we had half a page in the paper, you know, with nothing to put in it, which was, you know, quite normal. You know, I would rustle up, you know, a gig review or an album preview or an interview with some guy in a local band. And there was a local record store. The guy's still around, a guy called Tom Russell. I probably should not be admitting to this in case he phones the FBI or Interpol or something like that.
Don't tell me you stole records.
I would dispute the word stole, but you're on the right track. We used to have a competition each week where, you know, we asked a question and the winner, whoever it was who got the question right, got two singles of their choice from Tom Russell's record store. Now, Tom Russell had a record shop, a chain of record shops all around Scotland. But one of the main ones was in a little sort of precinct at Bishop Briggs Cross. And everybody always thinks when you do these competitions, you know, it's like the Blue Peter Appeal. You get sack loads of mail, but you don't. You maybe get four or five entries in a good week. But there were some weeks I would deliberately make the question so obscure that nobody would get it and nobody would write in. So then Tom Russell would phone me and say, who's the winner this week? And I'd say, it's Mr. Smith from Kirkintilloch Road, and he wants, you know, Pretty Vacant by the Sex Pistols and Complete Control by the Clash, and I'll come over and collect them in 10 minutes and take them up to him. So that was a good way of kind of augmenting my record collection, because bear in mind I was only earning 19 quid a week, which, yeah, I had to pay all the bills and look after my wife and my family. So, you know, if I could get free records, it had to be done.
So Billy, you give us a clue there. We're what, probably 77, 78, 79, it's punk. That was the era.
Yeah, it was 77. I remember it vividly because I went to see, on Christmas Day of 1977, just about 2 weeks before Christmas, I broke the news to my mother, my late mother, that I wouldn't be down at the house for Christmas dinner this year. And she said, why are you working? And I said, no, I'm going to Huddersfield to see the Sex Pistols. So you can imagine that went down like an absolute lead balloon. But on Christmas Day, I left my wife and my kid and my mum and my dad and the family and jumped in a car with three mates, and we drove all the way down to Huddersfield to a place called Ivanhoe's, where the Sex Pistols played a gig which has now become, you know,
legendary.
One of the most legendary gigs of their entire career. In the afternoon, we just missed in the afternoon they played a gig for, you know, the kids of Striking Firemen. And had we known that, we'd just have sort of put the foot to the metal and get down there quick and seen that. But we didn't know that. So we just arrived at Ivanhoe's, which was this kind of run down kind of medieval style, you know, banqueting hall with shields and lances and swords on the walls and stuff. And it had just finished, but, you know, we got there and they were playing the proper gig, you know, the normal gig that night. And we saw the Sex Pistols, and I have to say they were astounding. So, you know, it was 77, and I remember coming back and, you know, writing about it in the paper and talking about the whole punk phenomenon, you know, which they, of course, spearheaded. And it was just so exciting. It was absolutely fantastic. But it went down like a lead balloon, you know, mum and dad and the family, that, you know, when they were sitting eating their turkey with their paper hats on. I was in Ivanhoe's in Huddersfield watching Johnny Rotten sing Anarchy in the UK.
Oh, man.
It's got to be done.
You've had many, many family Christmases since, I'm sure, but you only get that chance once. It's one of those things. Just paint the picture for, because there'll be people listening to this who love the Sex Pistols as I did, but never got the chance to see them live. I was 10 in 1977. But there'll also be people that don't really quite understand what those gigs were, what they represented and what the feeling was at them. Just take us back and paint this little picture if you can.
Well, what they represented was, you know, when you saw your favourite rock stars, you know, 1973, 74 was glam rock. So you saw Mark Bolan,
yep,
or you saw David Bowie, or you saw Brian Ferry, or you saw Steve Harley, or you saw Lou Reed, or you saw Peter Gabriel. And while they were huge stars, they were pretty unattainable. You know, you wanted to be Mark Bolan, but he was beautiful and you could never compete with that. David Bowie looked as if he'd been beamed down from Mars. So, you know, he came from a totally different planet. Brian Ferry, you know, looked as if he spent his entire waking life dressed in a tuxedo, hanging about, you know, the trendy bars of the West End of London with supermodels. And, you
probably
know, Lou
true.
Reed was just, no, Lou Reed was just completely, you know, unattainable because, you know, he was an American and he came from, you know, New York and he was a bit rough and ready. So, you know, although you had your favourite rock stars, you know, you could not really identify with them. You know, they were very separate to the life that you were leading. But when punk rock came along, it was that whole sniff and glue fanzine thing. You know, here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third chord, go and form a band. Now, I would love to have been a rock star, but I think I was realistic enough to believe that, you know, I did not have the talent to be a guitar player or a singer. I actually, you know, went through the motions of putting a deposit on a guitar once upon a time. I went down to McCormick's, the music shop in Bath Street in Glasgow, which every Scottish musician will know because everybody at some time has bought something from McCormick's. And I put a £6 deposit down on an Echo Ranger acoustic guitar. And this was going to be my passport to rock stardom. And they sent a guy up from the shop to my then mother-in-law to find out, you know, the address I'd given for the H higher purchase payments, the HP payments. You know, I was at the right address and, you know, I hadn't given them any kind of bogus information. And the guy gave us such a hard time that I marched down in Diglintnoe the next week and demanded my £6 back because, you know, they'd just given a a hard time, you know, and I took the £6 and I went down to Jackson's, the tailors, and put it down in a deposit for a suit. So that was the beginning and the end of any, you know, ambitions I had to be a rock star. So I thought, I want to get into the music business. So, you know, the way to do it is through journalism. So that was where, you know, journalism and music sort of, you know, both paths, you know, the fork in the road became one, if you like.
So those years, if we also think a little bit about what's happening in those years for you as a football guy and a boxing guy, you have got a very, very decent generation of Scottish footballers, a very good 74 World Cup, a potentially wonderful 78 World Cup that didn't turn out that way. And you've got this, at the same time, the start of maybe the golden age of middleweight boxers. Tell me how then that was kind of like working together with the music interest and with you on a building site and then in a newspaper? What role did sport play?
Well, it goes back to your childhood, really, because before we moved up to Springburn, you know, I lived in a place called Townhead in Glasgow. What team you supported, you know, was down to, you know, and I hate to say it because it just sounds so archaic now, but it was, you know, what school you went to and what religion you had. So, you know, I went to St. David's and St. James's Road, which despite its name was a Protestant school as opposed to a Catholic school. But my three best mates, Samuel Miller, Paul Avery and Ron Little, they were Catholic guys and they went to St. Mungo's Primary. Now, you know, the whole Catholic Protestant thing never bothered me and never bothered them whatsoever. But it was great, you know, they were Celtic fans, I was a Rangers fan. I would go to Ibrox with, you know, my grandfather, or, you know, when I got a bit older, go with my mates. And you'll remember this, Roger, you know, if you went down there and you spoke nicely to some guy who just came out of the pub, he would lift you over the turnstile.
Yes, indeed.
So you get in for free, you know, and then as soon as you get in, there was somebody trying to sell you spearmint chewing gums. Or the macaroon bars. I never quite understood why they decided that, you know, what you wanted in a freezing cold winter's day was a macaroon bar or a packet of Wrigley Spearmint. I never quite understood why that was. But, you know, we'd go to Ibrox, and in those days it was just open terraces, so you could stand behind the goal that Rangers were shooting into, you know, and then at half time you would walk round and, you know, stand behind the goal that, you know, that they were shooting into after the half time break. And it was great, you know, there was people like, you know, Andy Penman and Willie Johnson and Willie Henderson and John Gregg and Ronnie McKinnon and Dave Smith and Peter McCloy and Billy Ritchie and all those guys. And then, of course, Rangers, for some reason, had quite an influx of Scandinavian players. So they had Kai Johansson at number two and they had Erik Sorensen, who was the goalkeeper. I think they bought both of them from Greenock Morton. And then they had a guy who was like, you know, a revelation, a guy called Orjan Persson. I think they bought him from Dundee United, and he was the first guy I ever saw who, you know, when the cross came in from the right, he jumped up about 6 foot into the air and did a scissor hitch kick and volleyed it into the back of the net. And he used to do things like, you know, take a corner, and it was an in-swinging corner, and he'd take the corner and it would go in and he'd score direct for the... You'd never seen anything like that before. So, you know, seeing those guys was great, but also on the other side of the city, you had Jimmy Johnson, who was just, you know, anytime you saw him on Scotsport, on the telly, you couldn't take your eyes off him, or you know, Bertie Auld or Bobby Lennox or the guys who made up the Lisbon Lions. I mean, they were fantastic. And, you know, and I never get into this whole, oh, I hate them because they play for the other side. I do just sort of appreciated the fact that they were great players and you know, they were on your doorstep. And I mean, a great example of that was, you know, when I was about 11 or 12, I think we moved up to Springburn. And I went to Wellfield Primary School. And to get there, we had to walk down quite a long road called Edgefold Road. Now, this would be about 1968, I think. And there was a little sort of hill off it called Edgefold Place. And then a terraced house at the top of Edgefold Place, that was where Stevie Chalmers lived.
Yeah, European
and,
Cup
winner.
And,
you know, we would walk down. And we would stand there for ages in the morning, you know, be late for school, and we would stand there at lunchtime just to see Stevie Chalmers come out and get into his car. Now, even though, you know, we were Rangers fans and he played for Celtic, that didn't matter. You know, there was the guy who'd scored the winning goal in the European Cup final. And, you know, my big hero, you know, outside Scotland was George Best. And he, you know, endorsed these football boots called Stylo Matchmakers, which, you know, didn't they lace up the front? They laced up the side. In those days, you know, you only had Adidas Samba or Adidas Santiago. That was the only two kind of pair of Adidas boots that were available, but they were too expensive. So, you know, even for Christmas, your mother and father couldn't afford to get that, you know. So, you know, you couldn't afford to get it. So you just had to take, you know, boots at a Bata, the shoe shop, or Timpson's or whatever it was. But then later on, you know, when I was in my early teens, I got a pair of Hummel boots. Remember the white boots with the two black stripes?
Yeah.
And I got a pair of them, and they were great. You know, I was the only guy in the team that had a pair of white Hummel boots. And they were great for about the first 3 weeks you had them. But, of course, we're playing in black ash football pitches and red ash football pitches in the mud and in the middle of the Scottish winter. You know, they never stayed white for very long. And, you know, you couldn't get white boot polish. So that was that. And then, of course, even worse, a few months later, Alan Ball endorsed them. So that was a wee bit of a... a buttock clencher because, you know...
He wasn't popular in Scotland, no. Georgie
Best was one thing, but Alan Ball was another thing. But, you know, the boots did pay dividends, which I'll tell you about in a wee while. But those white boots, remember, I mentioned those because they will pay big dividends.
So tell us a little bit, you know, you didn't mention the boxing there. So football, like all of us, is a big part of the growing up. But where did the boxing come from?
The boxing came from, believe it or not, you know, a really bizarre story. It came from my mother. In February of 1964, we lived, as I said earlier, at number 30 Martyr Street, which was a tenement flat in the middle of Townhead. And at the close mouth, which for anybody who doesn't know is the entrance to the tenement, at the close mouth there was Jean's Dairy, where, you know, everybody went to get their milk and their bread and their butter and their potatoes and that kind of stuff. And I was in Jean's Dairy one day in February of 1964 with my mother, and I remember this vividly. Her and about, you know, three other female customers who were waiting to get served started having this really heated discussion. You know, they weren't falling out, but, you know, they were raising their voices saying, I hope Big Sonny just punches that stupid grin right off his face, and I hope Big Sonny just shuts his mouth up. I'm fed up listening to him. And I thought, you know, what are they talking about? And, of course, they were talking about Cassius Clay, who on the lead up to, you know, the world heavyweight title in Lewiston, Maine, in the 25th of February, 1964, or was it Miami? I can't remember. It was Miami, maybe. I can't remember. You know, he was on the lead up in the fight doing all the hype, you know, which he'd never seen before. There'd never been a boxer saying, I am the greatest, and, you know, if you give me jive, you'll go down in five and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, all these women, including my mother, were just saying, I hope Big Sonny just shuts his big mouth up. I'm sick listening to him. And I thought, who is this guy? I've got to find out more about him. So, you know, I started reading the newspapers, and that was how I discovered Cassius Clay. And, you know, and I was caught up in the excitement of the world heavyweight title when, you know, Liston never came off his stool at the end of round seven or whatever it was. And I was hooked. That was how it happened. But it happened in the most unlikely circumstances, hearing all these Glaswegian housewives going in to get their bread and milk, you know, saying that they hope Big Sonny would knock the smile right off of Cassius Clay's face.
Tell me what happened when Cassius Clay upset Sonny Liston, because that was such a seismic event. He was just such a young, unknown guy, apart from all the noise that he created. But as he said, right, he shook up the world. I mean, how did it feel then? It must have been electrifying.
It was electrifying because if you remember the kind of, you know, elimination fight, if you can call it, was just before that when he fought Henry Cooper. And whoever won that fight, whether it was going to be Henry Cooper or whether it was going to be Cassius Clay, they were going to go on to fight Sonny Liston, who at that time was, you know, long before Mike Tyson, was the baddest man on the planet. You know, he was the most fearsome and the hardest punching heavyweight boxer that, you know, anybody had ever seen, and certainly in, you know, the times that we were living in. Cassius Clay was saying, I'm the greatest, and, you know, predicting the rounds that he was going to... But everything he said, he did. You know, it wasn't that he was sort of shouting his mouth off and no backing up with his actions. You know, he was actually, you know, like Ron Seal, doing what he said in the tin. And that's what made boxing, you know, so exciting, because, you know, if he'd just been a bog standard fighter, which I don't think you could ever describe Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay as being a bog standard fighter, but if he'd ever been just a bog standard fighter who went in and did his business in the ring, I don't think he would have been, you know, remotely as sexy as he was, you know, when you had all the circus and the sideshow that went around him. So, you know, it was impossible not to get kind of hooked up by that. Because if you remember as well, you know, any time you turned on, you know, the telly on a Saturday night and there was any of the comedians, you know, whether it was a Freddie Starr or whether it was, you know, some of their comedians, they were all doing impersonations. I am the greatest, you know, I've been Sonny Liston and I'm only 23. You know, they were all even, you know, so it transcended boxing, you know, it moved into the fabric of day-to-day life. And you know, it was impossible not to get, you know, caught up and swept up by all that. And you know, I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked right from the get-go and have remained so ever since.
I hate to jump around, but I just have to with this particular one. And we'll come back to the twin track here of music shortly, and we'll come back to those Hummel boots because you've got me interested now as to how they're going to pay dividends later on. But later on in your life, you met Ali. Now, I'm not sure how much later that was and you know, how much further along, but describe that meeting and talk a little bit about how it must have felt for someone to meet a hero of that kind of stature of this.
It was 1978. And just after February in 1978, he'd just been beaten by Leon Spinks, you know, who'd only had 8 fights. Yeah. And, you know, nobody could believe that Spinks would have had a chance to beat him, but Spinks beat him. And that was a big shock. And, you know, around that time, he'd also made a movie called Freedom Road. And he came into London, you know, as part of the promotional junket to, you know, promote the movie. And by that time, I was doing the pop column for the Sunday Mail, because I mentioned earlier that I'd worked in the Bishop Briggs and Springburn Times with Nina Young, and her then husband was a guy called Noel Young, who was the deputy editor of the Sunday Mail. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. They needed somebody to do the pop column. So he said, you know, do you fancy it? So suddenly I was doing the pop column for the biggest selling paper in Scotland.
Huge
so I was
profile.
Working. I was working by day, you know, for the Springburn and Bishopriggs Times, this little local paper. But at weekends, I had my own column in the Sunday Mail, reaching, you know, millions and millions of people. And I got a phone call from this PR agency called Rogers and Cowans in London, who said, we're bringing Muhammad Ali over to London. Would you like to come down and interview him? Now, the interview was on a Sunday, which was bad for a Sunday newspaper, because it meant that, you know, you had 7
week.
Full days
yeah.
before the next edition came out. So, you know, by that time, any story you had was kind of dead in the water. But I said, look, I don't care. Yeah, I want to do it. So at my own expense, you know, the paper didn't pay for it. You know, I just get money and I get the train down to London, and I booked this little £6.50 bed and breakfast in Paddington. And I went down to the Dorchester Hotel. I mean, even that was a big deal. The Dorchester Hotel in Park Lane at, you know, 1 o'clock on the Sunday afternoon, and met the PR girl. And she took me up in the lift to, you know, the 10th floor or whatever. And as we were walking along the corridor, I could hear the voice. He was shouting and bawling, you know, from about 50 yards away. Unmistakable, I could hear Muhammad Ali as he was wow. then. I could hear Muhammad Ali's voice, and I thought, wow. So she opened the door and we walk in, and there's Ali and his entourage. And the reason he was shouting and bawling, you know, because he never had any such thing as a quiet conversation when it was with Muhammad Ali, was that the guy who came in to interview him previous to me had made the mistake of questioning him about his religion. And Ali had this big folder, you know, about the Nation of Islam, and he was giving the guy chapter and verse. And of course, you know, we were running late, and nobody had the bottle to come and go, look, champ, we need to move on, you know, because he was in the middle of this big diatribe about, you know, what religion meant to him, kind of thing. But we go into the you know, the room, and of course, I'm supposed to be doing the next interview, but we're late because he's got to go to Radio 1 to do a live interview. And of course, you know, he had to be there. So I then had to interview him in the back of a limousine, him and I sitting in the back of the limo, driving from the Dorchester up to the top of, you know, just beyond Regent Street, just beyond Oxford Circus, to get to the BBC. And of course, we turn up at the door, and there's Ali, and there's this official photographer who's a guy called Howard Bingham, and there's all his entourage, and there's about 3 or 4 girls from the PR company. So there's maybe about 10 or 12 of us. And as we get to the door, this little concierge kind of Jobsworth guy comes out, you know, with the braided cap and the uniform, you know, the kind of commissioner, the chief of the commissioners, and he sees Howard Bingham with a camera on his neck, and he says, no cameras allowed in the BBC. And Ali says, no, you know, he's my man, you know, wherever he goes, I go. And they say, no, you can't get in without the cameras. No, no, you know, he's my man, he's good, because everywhere Ali went, Howard Bingham went and photographed him, you know, so he's got the most comprehensive record of Ali's life and career in pictorial terms. So by this time, we're in the foyer of the BBC building, which I'd never been in before, and the concierge guy goes to phone the head of security to get reinforcements. And we're standing there, and of course, we're late for this afternoon show, which was live. And Ali just looked around. You'll think I'm making this up, but Ali just looked around and went, let's go. And he ran. And of course, Howard Bingham ran after him, and I ran after Howard Bingham, and the other 10 people ran after me, and he bust through these swing doors with this guy shouting, come back, you can't go through there, stop, stop, stop. And we burst through these swing doors, and suddenly we were in the bowels of the BBC building. I didn't know at the time that it's kind of circular, so you know the corridors go around in a circle. And we ran down a stair, and suddenly we were in the bowels of the BBC. And of course, Ali was the most. Harry Carpenter said at the time that he was the most famous man in the world. You could take him up in an aeroplane to 35,000 feet with a parachute in his back, and you could kick him out the door of the plane, and no matter where he landed, in the middle of the Amazon jungle, in the middle of the Antarctic, in the middle of the, you know, the desert, the first guy he met would have known him. That's how famous he was. So, you know, suddenly we're in the bowels of the BBC building, and there's all this kind of ancillary stuff, a lot of whom were black guys and black women, the women that worked in the canteen, the guys who were the cleaners. And, of course, he was charming all the women and giving them kisses and hugs. Hey, there's a charm, you know, give me a charm, I want a kiss and I want a cuddle and all that. So he's kissing and cuddling all these women. And, of course, he can't do that with the guys. So, you know, he's putting his hands up and he's shadow boxing with the guys and all that. And, you know, suddenly we somehow, and I don't know how we did it, we managed to find our way to the radio studio where he was to take part in this live interview. And we got to sit in on that. And part of the interview, it was, remember John Lowe, the darts player who was the world darts champion?
First nine darts. Yeah.
He was one of the guests on it. And they had a dartboard set up in the studio, and they had a thread tied to a polo mint, and the polo mint was over the bullseye of the dartboard, and John Lowe was going to try. I don't know why they were doing this on radio because you couldn't see it, but John Lowe was going to try and get a dart in the middle of the hole in the polo mint, which was hanging over the bullseye, and he did it. Fair play to him, he did it. So then they asked Muhammad Ali to do it. And of course, when he took the darts to his hand, because he was so big, it was like throwing, you know, javelins. You know, he missed it, of course, and nearly took the dartboard off the wall. But you know, so we went there. Then we went back to the Dorchester, and by this time, you know, he'd been up since about 4 a.m. praying, and you know, a walk and stuff like that. And we were sitting in the Dorchester, you know, the very ornate tea room where all these sort of wee posh old ladies were sitting having scones and afternoon tea. And, you know, they all knew who he was because he was so recognisable. And by this time he was out on his feet, you know, he was sitting with his eyes shut and he was drinking a cup of coffee and he was eating a piece of chocolate cake. But his eyes were closed because you could see he was tired, you know, he'd had a long day. And this little girl came up. And she said, excuse me, champ, could I get your autograph, please? So he opened his eyes, and instead of saying, you know, can you wait a minute? So he put the coffee cup down, his fingers were all covered in, you know, chocolate and icing and stuff, and he licked his fingers and dried them with a napkin. And he asked her name, and he wrote the autograph, and she said, thank you. And she turned and walked away, and he went, little lady, little lady. And she got the fright of her life. I mean, we all get the fright of our life, and she just about jumped to her skin. He says, haven't you forgotten something? And I thought, Christ, he's thrown a wobbler about something. What's wrong with him? And I thought, well, I heard her saying, please, could I get your autograph, please? And I heard her saying, thank you, when he gave her the autograph. I thought, what's up with him? You know, he looked furious. What's up with him? And she got a bit of a fright, and he pointed to the side of his cheek, and he says, haven't you forgotten something? My kiss. And she gave him a wee peck in the cheek, and he gave her a hug, and away she went. So then a wee boy came up, and he got his autograph. So obviously he couldn't give the wee boy a kiss, so he held his hands up, and the wee boy was kind of
throwing punches,
doing the shadow boxing thing. And I mean, and then later on he was going to do another live interview. You know, I'd gone away by that time, but he was going to do another live interview at some radio station somewhere in the middle of the West End, and he was running late. And, you know, he got out the car, and he had to literally walk maybe 20 feet from the door of the car to, you know, the door of the radio station. And apparently he never refused an autograph. So some guy asked him for his autograph, and then suddenly, you know, buses stopped, cars stopped. There was 300 people, and they had to drag him in because, you know, they were going to be late for the interview. But, I mean, it was like hanging about with God. This was the most famous man in the world, and everybody loved him. And just to be in his presence, I mean, I got a couple of autographs, and I had my picture taken. And I ended up no writing a line for the paper, because when I got back, they went, that was last week. You know, that was last week. Jeez, he's been in all the papers. You know, we're not. But I didn't care. You know, I got to hang about in London for an afternoon with Muhammad Ali. And you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
You, am I wrong, Billy? You met him another time. Did you not meet him in McCoist at one point?
Yeah, I mentioned Howard Bingham there. It was in 1993 when Howard Bingham brought out this brilliant photo book called a 30-year journey, and it was published by this group called Robson Publications, who specialised in boxing books. And I got on to Mr. Robson, who was the head of the publishing company. He owned it, and I says, look, you know, you should come up and do a signing up here. The punters love them up here. So I worked for the Daily Record at the time, and we kind of had a hand in organising a signing session at Borders Books, which at that time was at the corner of Union Street and Gordon Street. It's now a cooperative supermarket or something. And through in Watson's in Edinburgh, I think it was in Princess Street. So the week before, Wet 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 had done a signing at Tower Records under the Healingman's umbrella, and about 1,500 girl fans had turned up, all screaming and all that, and the band played a gig out the window of the first floor of the record store and stopped the traffic. The cops were going nuts, stopped the traffic. They were going mental because there was 1,500 people in Nightingale Street and nobody could get past in the pavements or on the road. But 2 weeks later, when Ali turned up, there was 4,500 people outside Borders Books. There was a queue right along Gordon Street, away down Buchanan Street, along Argyle Street and back up again. And then he came, sat behind the desk, and everybody that came in, he signed a copy with a book, and they all got a picture taken with him and all that kind of stuff. And halfway through, I phoned Ibrox, and there was a guy who used to work at the front desk at Ibrox called Peter. And, you know, he was the first guy that you saw when you walked through the famous main doors at Ibrox. And I phoned up Peter and I went, where's McCoys? And he went, he's just finished training. He's just getting ready. I says, get him. This is an emergency. Get him. So he went and got McCoys. And I says, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just leaving. You know, I'm just heading home. I says, never mind heading home. I says, get in a taxi and get your arse over here. I want to do a picture for the paper. Now, you know, Roger, that McCoys got always many late. Great qualities. One of them is not punctuality and timekeeping, but this was probably the earliest he's ever been late. He was there in about 20 minutes. And I explained to Ali that this guy was the top soccer player in Scotland at the time. And he was also called Ali. So we did a picture of the two of them kind of, you know, squaring up, you know, as if they were going to have a fight. And I always remember my intro for the story. I said, this was the moment that Super Ali met the real Super Ali. And McCoy says that of all the people he's met over the years, and I mean he's met a few, that was probably the highlight of his career, because Ali was only supposed to sign books for a couple of hours, but there were so many people there that he didn't want to turn them away, so he ended up overrunning by about 2 hours. And then I just assumed that the publishing company would have got him a car to take him through to Edinburgh, but they didn't. So believe it or believe it not, he went through to Edinburgh on the 4:30 train from Queen Street. The commuter special. So there's all these guys wanting them with their briefcases and, you know, getting home from work, and they're sitting in the train. There's Muhammad Ali and all his entourage, and he arrived at Waverley at 5:30. I think they got a taxi up to Princess Street, and he sat there for another 6 hours signing autographs. But it was magical, just absolutely fantastic. And there was a guy who really pissed me off, actually. There was a guy in one of the broadsheet papers, a Scotsman or something, who said that, you know, he did a big piece in Ali. And, you know, and he had a bit of Parkinson's at that time, but he wasn't really that bad. And he said that, you know, he'd come up with him on the shuttle and how sad it was to see this guy who'd been such a physical, specimen, you know, sitting for an entire hour practicing how to sign his name over and over and over again because he was going to do this book signing. And it really pissed me off, and the reason it pissed me off was because halfway through the signing, the book was £19.99, which was a lot of money back then, no mistake. He stopped the signing session and he went out onto Union Street. He walked out onto Union Street and there was a whole load of little kids and, you know, wee women out there shopping and stuff. And he knew that the little kids didn't have £19.99 to buy the book. So what he'd been doing on the shuttle was he'd all these religious leaflets and he sat and signed, autographed 100 of them, and he went out and handed out all these religious leaflets, and he thought, well, you know, I'm not trying to ram religion down your throat, but, you know, here's a religious leaflet, it's got my autograph on it, that means that you might not throw it away, so at some stage in the game you might read it, and if you get something good from it, it's job done. So that's what he did. He went out and he handed out all these leaflets to all these kids and, you know, wee women and guys stand at the bus stop and that, you know, so they all got his autograph on one of these religious leaflets.
Fantastic. Absolutely amazing.
Tell us about weigh-ins in boxing when it all kicks off. I mean, really kicks off.
I was what year would it have been? It would have been the late 80s. And I was going over to Las Vegas on holiday with my partner. And we were hiring a car and going to, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles and Las Vegas. And we timed the trip to coincide with Mike Tyson fighting Donovan Razor Ruddock. He'd already had one fight, which Tyson won, and this was the rematch. And I thought, I wonder how you could get tickets for the fight. So at that time in the Daily Record, we had a boxing writer who was a former boxer, a guy called Dick Curry, a great guy. And I says, Dick, I says, how would you get tickets for the Tyson fight? Would they cost, you know, like $500 each? How would you do it? He says, why don't you try and get accredited for it? And I went, how do you do that? So he gave me a number to phone Don King's office in New York. And the woman sent me a fax. Remember them? She sent me a fax. And I filled the fax in with all the details, you know, the Daily Record and Billy Sloan and blah, 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 and faxed it back to her. And lo and behold, managed to get accredited for the fight.
Golden.
So that meant that you got, you know, the Willy Wonka golden ticket. You got the laminate pass that you wore on your neck with your seat number.
All areas.
All areas. So I would go into the big boxing HQ, which was in the Mirage Hotel, you know, the one that's got the volcano outside it.
Yeah.
On the strip. And there would be, you know, all the old timers for all the papers in New York, all the guys with the braces and the big cheroot cigars, and there was Don King walking about being interviewed, and it was absolutely amazing. It was incredible, right? And then on the night of the fight, you know, I didn't get a ringside seat, but I got a seat, you know, up in the tier, but it was still a $400 seat. And, you know, the guy would come on into the ring, go, you know, we've got some celebrities here tonight. Well, let's hear it for Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold would stand up and take a bow. Let's hear it for Sylvester Stallone. Let's hear it for everyone. Jack Nicholson. Everywhere you looked, there was like a movie star looking back at you. So Tyson goes into the ring and fights Donovan Razor Ruddock. It wasn't much of a fight. I think he knocked him down in round three and then he won in points. But, you know, it was a bit of a... bit of a non-event, but it was still a big deal to be there. So the next day they had a press conference. Now, it was nothing like it was now. There was only maybe 40 or 50 people there. And there was Tyson sitting up, you know, at the top table, you know, talking about, you know, his performance the night before. And they took him out, and after it finished, they took him out into a corridor because he was leaving again. And he had like three or four security guys with him, so you couldn't get near him. You couldn't get near him. So I was trying to get an autograph, or I was trying to get a picture. And, you know, you couldn't get close to him because every time you went near him, these guys were shoving you at the road. And he was in the middle of this kind of bubble thing. And then I said, Mike, you know, I've come here from Scotland. And he heard the accent. And he went, oh, you're from Scotland? And I went, yeah. And I went, there's been some great boxers from Scotland. I says, Ken Buchanan. But he didn't really know him. I says, Benny Lynch. He went, I know Benny Lynch.
Oh, wow.
And as soon as he said that, that was my kind of passport to get into the bubble, because as soon as he started having a dialogue with me,
you were in.
The four security guys let me in, so they were shoving everybody else up against the wall. But Mike Tyson suddenly and I were walking through the Mirage Hotel backstage like the Queen and Prince Philip. And I said, Benny Lynch was the first Scottish world champion way back in the 30s or 40s or whatever it was. And he says, oh, I know Benny Lynch, I love Benny Lynch. And I said, my boss in the Daily Record, who's a guy called John Burroughs, was a great guy. Sadly, he's no longer with us. I said, he wrote a book about Benny Lynch, you know, the definitive book about Benny Lynch. I said, if you give me your office address, I'll get a copy and I'll send it to you. And he went, I know the book, I've read it. And I thought, how could he possibly have read the book? And he went, I've read it. And I gave him one of the I Sure looks. And he went, it's a little book, white cover with a picture of Benny Lynch on the front cover. He says, but he was a great little fighter. He says, but too much of this. And he made a sort of bottle going up to his mouth. He says, too much of that. That's what killed him. And I thought, Christ, you know, because he's a bit of a boxing historian. Yeah. So suddenly we go from backstage and we're out in the casino floor. And of course, folk, there's Mike Tyson. So they're all jumping up on blackjack tables and roulette wheels and all that, trying to take pictures of him, and him and I are walking through like the Queen and Prince Philip, all the way through the casino to his car, which was parked at the front, And as we got to the car, I says, you know, mate, you should come and fight in Scotland. I says, because the punters love you there. And he turned and looked at me and went, you get me the money and I'll come and fight. See you later. And he jumped in the car and away he went. So that was the first time I met him. And then I went to a few other fights. I went to the ear biting fight, you know, Holyfield and Tyson in Las Vegas when he bit the chunk out of his ear.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was supposed to be a shooting in the hotel after it. And of course, it was absolute chaos. I was there with my mother and father and we had to get up the next day. And that's maybe another story for another time, but that's a great story. And then I went to Memphis, to the Pyramid in Memphis, when he fought for the Undisputed Heavyweight Championship with Lennox Lewis, where he got knocked out in round 8. And of course, everywhere you looked, there was Leonardo DiCaprio. I went up and was talking to him, got a picture with him, got a picture with Donald Trump, who at that time was still in The Apprentice, Samuel L. Jackson, George Foreman, Thomas the Hitman Hearns. Everywhere you looked, there was like a famous face looking back at you. So at the end of the fight, you know, they're up in the ring and all the press are jumping about around the ringside. And I thought, I'm going to go in. So I climbed up onto the ring. And climbed through the ropes. And when Larry Merchant or whatever it was interviewing Tyson and Lennox Lewis, I was standing next to him. And my mate, who lived in Glasgow, it was about 5 in the morning, he was watching it on Sky Box Office or something, and spat out his tea. Jesus Christ, look, here's the TV, they're slowing the TV and all that. And then about 2 months later, I was at a gig at Edinburgh Playhouse, and a guy came up and went, hey, I'm sorry to trouble you, but I was watching Tyson versus Lewis in Memphis, and were you in the ring? And I went, yeah. And he went, how did you get in the ring? I went, it was dead easy. I climbed in. And I ended up in the ring with Mike Tyson, and I was shaking Lennox's Lewis's. I've got pictures of me shaking Lennox Lewis's hands when he's literally knocked Mike Tyson's sparkle and he's no beat the count. So, you know, you get things like that. And, you know, you go in before the fight, who turned up with the Klitschko brothers? They weren't that well known at the time. And I spotted them in a row. I was talking to the Klitschko brothers, who are about 6'5", and I've got a picture with the Klitschko brothers. And then, you know, you go to Vegas and there's Sugar Ray Leonard and there's Thomas the Hitman Hearns, and, you know, there's Mills Lane, the referee, and there's I interviewed Angelo Dundee. You know, these are stories maybe for
another time.
Two of us, but you know, sitting in a room with Angelo Dundee talking about the Rumble in the Jungle and the thriller in Manila, you know, doesn't get any better than that. Come on.
Well, we promised you some great stories. We promised you a master storyteller. And I think, Rog, we've delivered on both of those. What do you reckon?
Yeah. You know, I think we could probably tell this that you were the guy quarterbacking all of this, Grant. And when you said, I want to put out all 2.5 hours, I think I had some form of a heart attack and significant pushback. And I tried to say, well, let me have a look and see what we can cut out. And the reality was, I just felt that I didn't want to lose anything. And I hope people agree with that. You know, it's a long podcast, at 2 parts, but these are anecdotes that are timeless and from people that we all know, and we've all seen in our timelines for the last 30 years. So I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as I did.
Yeah, likewise. And there's plenty more where that came from, as you'll find out when we release part two of this fantastic conversation. So that all that remains is to thank you for listening. Please, please, please give us your feedback on this, because if you guys enjoy listening to this as much as we did putting it together, then we will do our very best to bring more of these conversations to you with as many names with great stories to tell as we can find, and Billy Sloan will be instrumental in this. Follow us on Twitter if you don't already. You'll find us at EntertainedR. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. We'll see you for part two of our conversation with Billy Sloan very soon. Thanks for listening.